Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show, and we are all about helping entrepreneurs succeed. And many times entrepreneurs need to go get financing. And one of the ways of doing that is going out and seeking venture capital money or angel investment type money. And our two guests today, Che Voigt, he's the founder and CEO of Altwork, and Julie Arsenal, founder and CEO of Panty Drop. They are part of my portfolio. I'm invested into these companies, and they've gone out and got venture capital financing. And what they've discovered and what they've proven is that by communicating appropriately with your stakeholders, communicating appropriately with the investors that you have, that it can really be helpful. And today we're going to talk about why to communicate so well. I think we know communication is important, but why is it so important in this realm? And we're also going to talk about how to best communicate to our stakeholders, to our investors, in order to help us win as entrepreneurs. So stick around. I think you're going to like today's show. Again, Che Voigt, Julie Arsenal. This is the Mark Haney Show. Today, we have chosen the most exciting topic in the world for entrepreneurs. It's investor communication. I have with me a couple of my business partners, Julie Arsenal. She is the founder and CEO of Panty Drop. And we also have Che Voigt. He is the founder and CEO of Altwork. And both very strong entrepreneurs. But maybe we'll take a second, start with you, Julie, a little bit. Maybe just give us a little bit of your, a little bit about your company and how you gotten started into Panty Drop. And then we'll dive deeper into the communication piece.
Sure. So Panty Drop is a women's intimates company for all shapes and sizes. We recognize that there was a huge amount of inequality in the fashion space. Two-thirds of women are plus size, so larger than an extra large, but still largely excluded from most major retailers and brands. And so we wanted to solve that problem. And we ended up designing a better fitting plus size underwear. We carry our line in extra small to six extra large, so 0 to 34. And we're an e-commerce business, native online, direct to consumer from the very beginning.
All right. And what's the stage of your company? Are you a startup? Are you kind of midway?
Yeah. So I think of us very much as a startup, and I would say we're probably at the seed stage.
Okay. How about you, Che? Can you give us a little overview?
Yeah, sure. So talking about Altwork, what Altwork did is we set out to change the way that humans work with their computers in the way their body is supported. Right. So everybody's been working on different interfaces, different apps, different ways of working with the apps on the computer. But we've been just incredibly stagnant with how we work with the computer. Everybody, I can see it right behind you, Mark. You're just like everyone else. Hey, I have a flat surface. My computer goes on the flat surface. I bend my body to my computer, and I'm simply shocked that I have back pain, neck pain. And in many cases, this becomes absolutely debilitating and people are no longer able to work. So it's not like, oh, it kind of hurts a little bit. This is a big deal. This is the part of my conversation where everybody starts sitting up straight.
Yeah, if you're watching on YouTube, my neck does hurt me a little bit and I do slouch and I got to fix that.
Well, and the reason you do that is, and then that's part of the culture that is really unfortunate, is that we've told people, well, it's your problem. If you were more disciplined, if you stood up straight more, if you did this, you wouldn't have this. Well, okay, maybe a little bit, but you know what the real problem is the way the computer's set up that you're supposed to work with all day, and now we're on Zoom all day and social all day, you've got to bend your body to a computer that is not in the right position for you. So Altwork set out to change that. And what we did to do that is we effectively created a very comfortable seating surface that has full support from the headrest you can see here, all the way to the feet. And then the mount for the screen and the mount for the desk where you put your keyboard, mouse, whatever you're using, moves with the body like an exoskeleton. We did a huge amount of research on this. And we actually have patents on this, both US and international patents, about how those motions are supposed to be. So when you need to recline a little bit, the screen comes with you. So that's what we're trying to do, is fundamentally change that. And we're trying to do that for a lot of people. Some of our customers absolutely cannot work any other way. They have very significant problems. Maybe they were genetic issues that they were just born with, or maybe they were injured over time. But this is a really serious big deal. So in the US alone, there's, I don't have last year's data, but I think 18 data is the last one I have, is 1.6 million spinal surgeries, right? That's the last resort of back pain. Meanwhile, yeah. We've got people all over the world who are now doing this giant shift to work from home, and we're rethinking what work looks like. And, you know, Altwork is really growing because of that.
Yeah, you guys are both, Julie, both you and Che are solving important problems and really kind of in areas where we might not think that the solution exists, but it does. But, you know, the other problem, you know, as we dive into today's topic, we're talking about really communication and who we have to communicate with and why. And I want to dive in. So I'm fortunate enough to be business partners. I'm a small investor in each of your companies. As an angel investor and as somebody who invests into a number of companies, some of our portfolio founders do a really good job on communicating. We understand what's happening in their business. We understand why their business is important. And we understand, you know, what they're doing. Communication really sits, I think, at the forefront of the success factor. So, Julie, let's talk about that with Panty Drop. You're an early stage company. You've called yourself a startup, and the why behind communication with your investors specifically, right? You're early stage, and you want to keep us informed. Why?
Yeah, two big reasons for that. You know, the investor update is a really good place to, as a source of help. So when you start a company, you need help in a lot of different areas, right? You need team members to do, you know, bring their expertise. You need business partners to bring their expertise, investors to bring capital. Like, there's so many areas where you need help. And I think the investor update is probably one of the best ways to make sure you're keeping the people that are closest and most invested in your success ready to help. And so, you know, people can help in all kinds of different ways. And sometimes that's a check, sometimes it's a networking connection, sometimes it's advice. And, you know, so I really think that, but if you're not telling people what's going on and not showing where you might need some help, there's no way for them to know. And so actually, I think we do two types of communications. We have an investor update, which includes, you know, financial data and some confidential information. And then we also have an update, we call it friends of company update, which doesn't include some of the, you know, more detailed financial metrics. And it pretty much goes to everyone that I've ever spoken with about the company. Mm-hmm. So friends, family, you know, professionals. And the investor update goes to people who have invested or who might become investors very soon. And so, you know, I think it's just a really great way to let people know what you're doing, a relatively lightweight way to keep in touch with people that have helped or expressed some interest in what you're doing. And we've had people come out of the woodwork. You know, they've been on our update list for a year and, you know, never heard anything from them. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh, I know someone, like they see one of our help wanted asks and I know so-and-so and you guys should have a chat, or, hey, you sound like you're, you know, things are going really well. Like, I'm actually interested in investing now. So I think we found a number of like surprising things come out of the woodwork there. And in terms of our ability to use that as a vehicle to get help, you know, I think there's also just like, if people are writing you a check and investing in your company, like you kind of have a responsibility to keep them up to date. So like, it's just part of being a professional. So you really should do it. And then I think the other big reason why we do it is, you know, we don't have a formal board yet. You know, our first rounds were on convertible notes. So we never ended up forming the formal board. I'm still the only person that sits on the board, but eventually we will have a board and there will be, you know, investor board members. And so the investor update's a really good way just to get in the practice of having those kinds of conversations and thinking through that kind of communication and kind of like dry running what might be in a future board meeting or some of the things you might want to talk about in a future board meeting. So I think it's a good way to kind of prepare for that in a lower risk way.
Well, Che, your business is a little further along, and I'm kind of curious, were there learnings along the way where at the beginning you communicated in one way and now it's expanded now that your business is taking off?
Yeah, actually, you know, so this is not my first rodeo, as we say. And I was thinking about, okay, so I've gotten over the years a lot of compliments on my investor communications, and I really appreciate those. But as I thought about it, I've got a lot of complaints early on. So, you know, I've been through a number of startup companies, small companies, and companies that I got acquired. And I do remember the most important lesson that I got from the first time was from one of our board members, Steve Weiss. And I was writing he was head of the North Bay Angels at the time, experienced venture capitalist, all this kind of stuff. And he was on our board. And I used to spend, I don't know how long, on a monthly report that was like a 3-page narrative for an engineer to write, which is like a novel, right? It was terrible for me to write. And his problem was it was terrible for him to read because it was a free-form creative writing novella. And every year, every month was different. So the first lesson I learned was standardization. And he came on me. He's like, look, this is the stuff I want to know. This is the stuff I want to know that's different every month. Keep it in the same format and keep it at one page. So that was one of my early lessons.
I have to imagine that is a lot easier than the free form, soliloquy or whatever, the longer paragraph form.
Yeah, it was. It literally gave me probably a day or two, a month back in to execute on. Because investors want to know what's going on, but obviously they didn't invest in order to get reports from you. They invested so you can grow the business. I think that was a really, really important lesson, is a standardized format. What's important? Because there's something that's generally important about your business all the time on a theme level. And that theme will change, right? For us, when we were having production challenges, that dominated the report, right? Until we got all of those things behind us, and then in which case it goes to order fulfillment, any warranty issues, that's the theme for the next stage of the company. And you're always going through these different themes, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't sit there at the beginning and write a book and say your startup has these following items that you should always report on. But there are generally stuff that you're always going to report on, plus the current theme. It doesn't have to be a crisis. Hopefully it's not a crisis.
Yeah.
But you have these are the problems we're working as a team to solve. And mm-hmm. I think that feels like the right tempo for people. I don't think less than quarterly is good for any company. There's a reason that public companies do quarterly reports. It makes sense to them. I do think that, Julie, to your point, when you're asking for help often, when you're really in a dynamic situation, monthly is completely acceptable for investors. So no more often than monthly would be my suggestion, and no less than quarterly.
Let's talk about the investor reports to start with. Are there KPIs? Are there certain metrics that are very important to you, which you want to relay to the investors?
Yeah, absolutely. And echoing what Chase said about having a standard format, so helpful. So you're not thinking each month about what to put in there. We have a standard set of KPIs, which reflect kind of the key operational metrics that align to our goals. That's at the top. Well, there's a company description, just, people end up on the list and you want to make sure they remember who you are and what you're doing.
Remind us what the business is. The thing is, with your business, it's pretty easy to remember. Panty drop. It's like, how many underwear companies might somebody be invested into?
Yeah. Company description, KPIs. We report, even though we send updates monthly, we tend to report the KPIs quarterly. So it'll be previous quarters and then quarter to date. And then highlights, lowlights and learnings, trying to remember the other sections. Product, so what we released on product and what's coming next, what we're working on. Financials, so burn, monthly burn, cash left in the bank and runway. And then any progress on current round financing initiatives. Press, if we've gotten press coverage. Kudos, so thanks, where we have an opportunity to thank people that have been helpful for us in the recent timeframe. And help wanted. Pretty sure those are all the sections.
You have all these sections. All right, let's talk about sections. A lot of people want to know about investors want to know about the financial piece, right? So you talk about revenue and cash left in the bank and, the burn rate if somebody is burning cash, or maybe if you have cash positive, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Where do you get the most engagement in those realms? I mean, are people wanting to kind of reach back out to you and discuss any of this?
Yeah, sometimes. Some investor updates we send out and I don't think we hear anything back. And then some we send out and we hear, lots of things back. I think we get responses often, congratulating us on highlights or progress, especially if we've had a particularly notable milestone that we achieved or worked on, made progress on. The lowlights and learnings. I think one of the things that was really hard for me, or, kind of just maybe a mental block getting over the first, when I started doing this was, I think sometimes you start it and you think, oh, I have to be really positive in all of these updates. And I don't think that's true. Early stage investors know that there are a lot of ups and downs on the journey, and they're expecting you to run into challenges, and they're expecting you to realize that things didn't work out the way that you thought that they were going to work out. And that's a normal part of the process. And I think being really open and authentic in the learnings and lowlight section is important. And so we get people that say like, hey, that's a great learning. Like, you know, sorry, that didn't work out the way you thought, but like you handled it really well. Or, you know, so we get engagement there. And then, yeah, of course we get engagement on the financials. You know, most of the time, you know, I mean, I think we're just kicking off a new funding round. And so in our last investor update, you know, we let people know like, hey, this is coming up. Like we're going to be working on this. And actually it was great. A lot of people were like, you know, you've been making really great progress, but, you know, keep me posted on the round as it develops, like interested in, you know, investing more in the business. So I think there's a lot of opportunity, or yeah, those are probably the main places where we get engagement.
Hey, Julie, I wanted to reinforce one of your comments. I would say, Mark, that one of the hardest things to get right as anyone in a startup business, but especially the CEO, is tone, right? Because some days it just seems dark and some days it seems overly bright. And you also got to recognize that the investor is going to read that. Most rational investors, I believe, will read your report and say, okay, it's probably a little worse than this person's saying because they want to be positive. At the same time, it's horrible when I'm an investor in other companies too, right? It's horrible when you get a glowing report, glowing report, glowing report, we're out of business, right? That's unacceptable. So that balance takes a lot of effort. And the other thing, Julie, I don't know, do you send your stuff out on a certain date?
I mean, this is one area where I feel like we could be a little bit better. My goal is to send it out the first Monday of the month, unless the first Monday of the month, like, falls on the very first day, because we need a couple of days to pull the metrics and like put it together and gather all the data, right? So, and input from the team. So I try to send it on essentially the second Monday, probably like the Monday of the second week of the month. But, you know, sometimes I'm a little bit late and I try not to beat myself up over that. I've occasionally missed one. I also try not to beat myself up on that too and just get back on the horse and just send it out.
It's curious about
the
that.
Monthly ones are hard.
Sorry about that, Chad. I didn't mean to interrupt. Thinking about that, because I think that's an interesting dynamic in leadership, how to share an optimistic point of view. Everything's going to be okay in the end, but yet be as authentic as possible and sort of balancing that without writing the book, right? Because metrics and trend lines, they don't lie. Thoughts on that, Jay, and how you, because you guys have had, you ended up with some challenges, if I remember right, a year or two ago with some of your factories, if I remember right.
So production. Many challenges. hardware is hard. It's right in the first name. First word. So a good example on that, let me pull your question apart into two areas, right? Yes, metrics don't lie, but they don't necessarily have the flavor. And I always look for both of those. In general, I don't put a whole lot of trend lines in my reports because I think they can be misleading if there's not a good explanation for them. The other thing that I'll talk about more is all my reports are one page, so there's not a lot of room. And I have a very specific reason for that. But going back to you use the metrics, you use the trend lines to kind of try to understand where it's going. And then it's your job as the chief executive to try to figure out what is the truth behind and in between those numbers. And that's a real challenge.
What's the reason for the one pager?
So one, I'm very much a Toyota production system person. And a big part of that is the so-called A4 report, which that is a business size letter in the United States. The Japanese and European styles are slightly different, but that's what A4 means. I grew up doing a lot of aerospace stuff, and there's a saying in the military that everything, including World War III, can be summarized on a quad chart if you have to brief it that way. So I got pushed in that direction. But where it really just hammer home for me is we got acquired by the sixth largest aerospace company on the planet, and I was reporting into the CEO on a quarterly basis in Manhattan. It was a big deal, and I was, you know, very nervous, all this kind of stuff. And so my boss's boss had asked me about the status on a particular program, and I worked my butt off to make it down to only three slides so that I could accurately explain everything that was going on in the program. I was at the, you know, I'm on the 34th floor of Midtown Manhattan, beautiful view. I hand him the report and I'm like, okay, here it is. This is what you asked for. And then about 3 weeks later, I get a phone call where he's just, there are a bunch of Italian culture there, and there was a lot of yelling, certainly a lot of expletives. Trying to explain what the hell's going on this program that I asked about. And I said, hey, I had all this stuff in here and I don't know why you're confused. I'm very sorry, Jim. You know, how could you have missed that? And he said, well, I only read the first page. I'm like, so even three pages is not acceptable. It's one page or you didn't communicate it. So ever since that, it's like, if it's important, it's on one page.
Is more of your business, Jay, direct to consumer, or is it more B2B?
That's a fascinating question, because a year ago, right now, I would have told you that our big growth potential, and it's probably in my reports actually from that time, our big growth potential was the B2B opportunity in the SF Bay Area. We had enough DTC work that we knew the product was well received, and we really needed to start working the B2B side. And, you know, I actually moved my primary residence to San Francisco. I had an apartment there already and made some big changes. And we did that, and it worked for all of about 4 weeks. You know, the impromptu meetings, the, hey, go over here and meet this person. Oh, I'm just down the street. All that stuff works out great in downtown San Francisco. However, pandemic hit and it's all over. And so what was funny to me is we were, you know, interviewing advisors and people to help us in the B2B market. And everybody was like, okay, well, you got to do this, this, and this. And then around May, we start getting phone calls from them saying, so how do you guys sell over the internet? Because we don't know how to do that and we got to figure it out. So there was such a radical shift that I've got a lot of gratitude that the one thing that we really had working was D2C, because that's really all that mattered for the last 9 months. Who knows what's going to happen from here on out, but it's certainly a stronger component in our business than we thought it would have been a year or two ago.
Yeah, because I noticed, Julia, and you know, you're a direct-to-consumer brand, and some of your metrics that you report out have to do with things like cost of acquiring a customer and churn rate and things like that. And you keep a close pulse on that kind of stuff. How do you gather that data? Is that out of a system of some kind?
Whole different system. So yeah, metrics are really important. So we use Google Analytics to get website data. You know, obviously our payment processors have the revenue data. We also have a couple of custom integrations that we've built in custom reports to help us track the number of new customers. Our tech stack as a business has grown and evolved over time, and it got kind of complicated as we had, you know, as things evolved. And so we had data in a whole bunch of different systems. And so I think that's been one of our challenges. I just go through this exercise actually weekly. We review metrics together weekly as a team, and then I do the monthly updates. So just go through an exercise where every week I'm gathering that information and putting it into our spreadsheets, and same thing on the monthly basis too.
Well, I sort of wonder that for both of you is, okay, so as a leader, I think just being successful in life, the way we allocate our time is a pretty big key, right? Maybe the most important thing is, what we do with our time and how we spend it. You're talking about these numbers and evaluation and then communicating them out. How much of a CEO's time, especially at these earlier stages, should be spent just in the evaluation mode and then communicating out to your constituencies? Is that a big piece of the time?
It is for me. What you're really asking is how much of the CEO's time is looking at the data plus the non-data side to come up with what should we do, right? The way I think about this, so we had our strat meeting. When we're a bigger company, we'll do our strategy meetings in the fourth quarter, but we do them in the first quarter now. But I got three things that this company needs to get done this year, and that's it. If we got those three things done and nothing else, it'd be awesome. Now, those three things require so much more to be done. And so breaking that out and then communicating to the team, one could honestly say that's the job of the CEO, is what's important, communicating that to the team and making sure that the customers understand that. And of course, if you're investor backed, your investors have to know. You know, I got an engineering as training, but most of my time is spent communicating.
How about you, Julie? What percentage of your time is in this, let's call it analyst, yeah, you know, analyzing the data and then communicating it?
You know, maybe right now it's probably about 20. If I had to guess, I'd say 25%. But I think it varies over time. And so I'm not surprised to hear Chai say that he's a little later stage, right? So he's spending a lot of his time on it. You know, the time that I'm spending on it has absolutely grown in the past 2 years, I think, as the company has grown. So, you know, in the beginning, if it's you and your co-founder, you know, you're probably just naturally seeing the same things, looking at the same things, because you're working so closely together on the same projects or the same goals or the same initiatives. It's really easy to stay in sync. As you start to add people and, you know, people with maybe different functional areas that they're responsible for. So, you know, we have a marketing lead and we have a product lead and we have a developer lead. You know, as you start to add that, then I think the communication and the accountability around the metrics becomes a much bigger focus, where this is how we all stay aligned. This is how we know what's important, how we're tracking our progress, holding ourselves and each other accountable to those things. And then also, yeah, making sure that we all know what we're working on and why, and working towards the same objective. So, you know, I think, I think that changes as the team grows. And in the beginning, when it's just you and, you know, one other, two other people, you probably don't need to spend as much time on that, because you're working on you know, the building the product or selling to customers. But as the team grows, then I think you need to be a lot more thoughtful about how you keep everyone in sync.
Well, thinking about the, oh, go ahead, Jay.
Well, I was going to say, Julie, do you have a co-founder?
I'm a solo founder, but we have about 5 people on our team now. And so I have kind of the leads team, essentially the leadership team of those like 3 to 4 key employees that have the functional ownership.
I could never do that because there's so many things that I am horrible at. It must be nice to be gifted at enough things where you can actually operate a business by yourself at some level for a period of time. So I'm impressed with that. But typically, I don't even invest into companies that don't have a team built out or a co-founder. But go ahead, Jay.
Well, one of the things that I was going to mention to Julie is because we've had such challenges over our history, I think one of the things that hasn't been discussed about internal communications, especially if you have a co-founder, is what happens when one of your early hypotheses that you were so convinced was true turns out to not be true. That's a big time commit. I don't joke. This is like, you know, one of those wisdom notes or whatever, but there's nothing more dangerous in the world than an idea that's wrong that you're highly confident in.
Is there a story behind that that you or an experience share?
So many. But we built up entire supply chains based on people that were never going to make it. And it's incredibly disappointing when that happens, especially when it feels like maybe there's some ethics involved there. And they didn't want to try, but you believed in them or somebody else believed in them. And so for us, because we're hardware, supply chain is so important to us. Picking the right partners in your supply chain is just unbelievably critical. And we had some ideas about, oh, those people will never be able to do a good job because of this. And those people are always going to be able to do the best job because of this. And when one of those basic tenets was wrong, it was hard to accept. It mm-hmm. took us a while. So again, I don't hear many startup tales talk about that as much as maybe they should.
So we're on this journey of entrepreneurship. And one of the things that happens with a lot of companies is they go out and get that seed round friends and family round, seed round, Series A. There's this sort of journey or progression in the building of the business and continuing to hit milestones, raise a little bit more money and really grow the business. Kind of curious. I don't really know where you two are at in that realm, but I can imagine, and I see this with other people, that communicating with prospective investors of the future, maybe your existing stakeholders, it may be people you don't know very well yet, but you want to keep them updated on your progress because, wow, I'd really like to land that person as an investor when I get ready to go out for my Series A. Have you thought about that at all, Julie?
Yeah, absolutely. And we have those people on our investor update list. You know, I think if you're fundraising, you've definitely heard you're too early. Like you're too early for us or you're too early for me.
What do you mean by that? Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I think it could mean legitimately that you are too early. Like they are a Series A stage investor. Yeah, like it could legitimately mean that you are too early and like they're a Series A investor and they, you know, want XYZ figured out and you're not there yet, but they do want to keep in touch. Or it could just be a nice way to say no. And, you know, that happens too. As an entrepreneur, I don't think you know the truth. You just kind of have to go with your gut feel. But, you know, people also say a no really means a not yet. And I always take that to heart. And so I have, you know, people on our investor update that I had a couple conversations with, ultimately decided not to write the check at the time. Maybe we were too early or maybe there was some other objection, but, you know, just keep them, I keep them on the list until they say, please take me off your list. And we've had a couple people that have said, take me off your list, but it's pretty rare. You know, and again, that's where the two different versions of the investor update, I think, or the update come in handy, because maybe for some of those people, you don't want to be sharing all your nitty gritty financials and your confidential product roadmap information, because you maybe you don't have that same level of trust that you do with someone else. But, you know, it's still good to keep them updated. And so we do have people on the list there's a couple investors that are later stage, and I chat with them quarterly. You probably try to set up around every 3 to 4 months a phone call just to give them an update on how we're doing, what we're doing, some of the strategic questions that we're thinking through and get their feedback on it. Because people also say investors like to invest in lines and not dots. So by building up these relationships over time, showing them what you're working on, how you're doing, delivering against the goals that you set, figuring out the nuts and bolts of the business, it's a way to keep those relationships sort of warm. So that when you do go out to raise that Series A or that later stage round, you know, you already have a pool of people that know something about you and you're not starting cold. I think that's really helpful.
How did you discover that? So you're working these relationships, so it sounds like it's more targeted versus like some shotgun approach. How did you discover these relationships? You get out there in the world and just meet people? Is there a list you pull from? Because you want people that want to come into your world, right? That I think would probably be a better chance of, you know, somebody who wants a direct to consumer brands.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a little bit of both. I don't think founders can really afford to leave stones unturned. So you have to be careful about how you spend your time, but you also need to just talk with a lot of people. Yeah. Again, like another benchmark that people say is like, if you want to raise a round, you're going to talk to 100 people and like 90% or 90 of them will say no and 10 will say yes. And those metrics have held true for us pretty much on all of our rounds. So that's a lot of conversations. But I do think that being targeted and thoughtful about how you approach that. So yeah, we do, you know, when we started raising our first round, I did that. I researched who was investing in companies like ours, made a big list, looked at who I knew that knew those people, because warm introductions still go a really long way in fundraising. I met with every founder that I knew and I was like, tell me about how, you know, what your process was like raising, whether they were in my industry or not. You know, fashion and apparel was a new industry for me. It's not what I had been working in before. So I also was building my network in that space as well. So, you know, just met with every founder, tried to figure out who would be good investors to talk with, you know, targeted investors. And tried to figure out how I could get a meeting with them, looked on AngelList and was like, who are the angel investors in Reno, Tahoe? And like, tried to find a way to get their email address. And I sent cold emails, like got warm introductions. I think it's just a lot of legwork in the beginning. The first round is definitely the hardest in terms of that level of heavy lifting. Because as you spend more time in this space, you know, you find new opportunities, people introduce you to others, and now your list of contacts grows. So it takes time. The first one's really hard. And then I think it does get easier as you go. But yeah, so, you know, I think I was doing list diligence. And then there's also like the networking. That's actually how I met Mark, was at a startup networking, you know, pitch event in Sacramento. And so you go to those events too, and you kind of just have to, you know, I think you have to have a multifaceted approach to your outreach strategy when it comes time to, you know, building that audience and meeting new people.
Maybe some advice for me, and I guess, because I don't know, we haven't really announced it formally yet, but I've been doing angel investing for the last several years, learning a lot, had a couple of the companies do pretty well. Your companies are doing well. And the track record is still, I'm at the infancy, but we're gonna start a fund. And so I, for the first time, will be out there trying to raise money and then invest other people's money. And so I'm very excited about it. But because I've never done it before, there is some level of trepidation, nervousness, nervous enthusiasm. Any thoughts to me or anybody that may be out there that, hey, I haven't gone through raising money yet, and to put yourself in the right mindset to get after it and be successful. Ours is going to be all around early stage companies in the region. So it's pretty targeted, but I'm still, you know, a little bit concerned about, you know, hey, how successful am I going to be? You know, how long is it going to take me? So thoughts?
I can put some thoughts here from a North Bay Angels perspective. You know, the North Bay Angels is an angel club, if you will. I use that word particularly because, you know, it's not Series 7, SEC certified, et cetera. It's never intended to be. It does not provide investment advice. It's a group of individual investors coming together and who have volunteered their time to bring good companies in front of good investors, right? So from that point of view, I think one of the things that the angel groups have need to do, and North Bay Angels has done this, is to network with other angel groups, because an individual angel club is not enough to get the company over the line. And there is such a disruption in the venture capital model between today and when it was established, if you will, 20 years ago. You know, it used to be a few angel investors, and then you would do a seed round of $500,000, which, I mean, literally add a zero on it now. And then it would go to the A round of $2 to $3 million with a small venture capital firm, and they would do some more, et cetera. And that model does not work that way anymore. But the big difference that we have seen is the companies that are successful are the ones that either raise enough money through the angel community to get themselves to a sustainable, bootstrappable way of growing, or have contacts into real venture capital to raise large rounds. And we've seen that happen with several of our companies. So that bridge, Mark, is hugely important to the company. Any one of those companies that you do an angel investment into, assuming that they need to get another next level of capital, which is almost assuredly, where's that coming from? Because your principal effectively goes to zero in the event that they, you know, they run out of oxygen for 3 months and that's all they needed. But if you don't have that, then your basis went to zero.
And I agree. And I'm trying to put the right teammates around me to help solve that bridge. You know, there's obviously a lot of dollars, VC dollars right down the street in the Bay Area. So finding that bridge to the Bay Area among others. So we're working on that. So, and I think, you know, in terms of putting myself in the right mindset, I think having the right team for me will give me a bit more confidence going into this endeavor. Julie, thoughts to the wannabe VC over here?
Yeah. One thing I heard from someone else who raised a fund recently was that it's harder than raising as a founder, because as a founder, you can go to like Crunchbase and like, you know, there are these lists of VCs and angel groups and you can submit applications. And that doesn't exist when you're raising a fund, because it's all, you know, individuals. It's like high net worth individuals who maybe haven't done this type of investing before. And so there's so I empathize because I've heard that it's even harder. You know, in terms of preparing for fundraising, I think some advice that I like to give is prepare for a process. So, you know, make your list, plan your outreach, think about how you're going to track and keep track of everything. So if you want to use a spreadsheet, that's fine. I think there's also a couple CRM tools that are good for this, because you're going to be reaching out to a lot of people and trying to follow up promptly. Get your docs ready. So, you know, make sure you're as a founder, I don't know what it looks like from a fund manager perspective, but as a founder, you know, make sure your pitch deck is ready, make sure your due diligence data room is ready, so that when someone asks for it, you're just sending them the link and you're not trying to scramble to get all this stuff together. You know, make sure you get your financial models together, you know, and so just kind of prepare so that when you actually go out to start having meetings, you can run a tighter process. Because I think time is really the enemy here. So, you know, you want to run a tight process, and I think you do that by being prepared. And then the second thing is just the mindset. You know, if you're not used to being in a sales role, fundraising is very salesy. So you have to prepare for hearing a lot of no's.
I can't accept that. I hate rejection.
Yeah. So I think, you know, and I also try to dedicate, you know, again, with keeping a tight process, like I make fundraising my number one priority when I'm fundraising. And that means that I'm not doing other things in the business. So that's where having the team is helpful, because I know that, okay, someone's paying attention to customer support and someone else is paying attention to marketing and growth so that I can focus on this. And so, dedicating the time and just, you know, you're going to have days where you're really tired and, you know, all your conversations didn't go the way you wanted them to, and you feel really crappy, and like, it's okay. And maybe just like take the afternoon off.
All right. Don't be afraid to take an afternoon off. I love it. All right. So we only have a little bit of time, so maybe I'll kind of let you each share any closing thoughts about your business. But I guess here's the question, but feel free to elaborate. I'll throw the same question at you. So, and I'll tie it back to our topic of communication. So if we were to look out into the future, let's say let's use 5 years as an example, but if you want to pick 10 or some distant time frame different, and you're communicating to your investors and to your stakeholders, I mean, what will you be communicating? What is the vision now look like? And what would, what's this win story going to look like? And how would you communicate it?
Actually, interesting question. So the former board chair for the last company that I started is former partner at McKinsey. And one of his recommendations, which is very hard to find the time to do as a CEO, was in January, write the shareholder letter that you want to write in December. And again, this is all about planning and what's really important. So if I look out in 5 years, what I would hope to write about is how Altwerk at one time might have been a little early to the idea of a massive change in the way people work. But as a result of the massive shift to remote work that the world went into, it became the best tool for the digital professional. And the ecosystem of products and accessories that we built around the digital professional was exactly spot on for that new environment. And Altwork should be a reasonable player. I don't want to call it necessarily a major player because this is a very big business, Mark. But what we want is, you know, we don't want to make all the phones like the Android model and Samsung does, but we do want to make a lot of the profit like Apple does and have the right product for the right people that's really custom to the entire ecosystem. What we're trying to do is bring, you know, people look at the Altwork station and say, oh, it's like a first class airline seat. And then we joke back to them and say, yeah, why do you go home and work in coach? Yeah. Right? This is where you spend a huge portion of your time. It's where you make your income for yourself and your family. Why should it be something that's uncomfortable? Why should it have long-term negative health effects? And why isn't it the most productive, most creative place for you to work? If you're going to put in the long hours, we have the best system for you. We believe that in 5 years, the marketplace will really see that. And we hope to have a couple people say, wow, where did you guys come from? How did you think ahead that way?
Yeah, changing the way that people work. You're in the process of doing that. A very inspiring way to think about your company. And appreciate that very much, Shay. All right, Julie, the Jeopardy music is ended. It's your turn.
Well, you know, our North Star goal is to be the number one size inclusive underwear company. So that's what we're working on. And so I hope that in 5 years, you know, our board presentation is a, you know, very coherent, wonderful set of PowerPoint slides that, you know, celebrates the success of maybe being there. But then also, you know, really diving into some of the, you know, new strategic challenges that we're hitting in terms of whatever, you know, the next level of growth or goal that we're trying to get to, you know, probably expanding the product line at that point, if we've gone as far as we wanted to and on underwear. You know, I think the other thing that I would say in closing is, you know, presumably some of the people listening to this are thinking about doing investor updates and haven't started yet. And I would say, you know, the best way to get started is just block an hour on your calendar, sit down. We actually do use software for sending this. So just, you don't have to, but think about like pick a software, MailChimp works, MailMerge works. We use something called Contactually, which basically just, you know, lets us like email multiple people at once and group people into contact buckets. But, you know, just pick how you're going to send it. And then just make that list of like, go back through, write down everyone that you've spoken to about the business that you think cares about what you're doing. If you're on the fence about whether you think they care, just add them to the list. You can always like, I stopped doing this, but you can always say like, you know, at the end, if you'd like to be removed from this list, just email me and I'll take you off. Or you can have an unsubscribe link if you're using MailChimp, and just make that list and just, you know, pick a template and just start doing it. And it's going to feel really uncomfortable at first, but the more you do it, the easier it'll get. And along the way, you'll also get positive feedback. So if you're an investor out there wishing that your companies did more investor updates, when you see one that you like, just reply and say like, great job. Or thanks for, you know, even if it's just like, thanks for sending this. I really appreciate how you're doing keeping us up to date. Because I think those little bits of feedback and help really help me keep going and realize that, oh, this is something that is really a good thing to keep investing time in.
And just a little, you're going to say something, Che? Sorry.
I was just going to agree. So one, Julie, great point about the more you do it, the easier it gets, right? And then also, we all live on a little bit of positive feedback sometimes when we send that investor report out, especially if it's a little dark, a little bit of comment back of hang in there probably goes a long way. It certainly has for me.
Come on, investors, you got to be engaged. One other thing I'll add too, and this is just a little plug. You use the word software, Julie. One of my portfolio companies actually is in this business. It's called AngelSpan, and it's actually I invest into founders, right? If I meet a rock star, I'm like, okay, I want to be a part of this. And this was actually a guy that I played high school football with. He went to the same high school I did with here in Sacramento. And his company is AngelSpan, and they have a complete system for helping the early stage company put their data in a very usable format and get it out to the investors. And it helps do some comparisons to other businesses in that industry to sort of give you feedback on how you're doing. It's really a pretty elaborate system, and it's called AngelSpan. It is one of my portfolio companies. They're based out of Austin, but since is my old high school football buddy, we decided to go a little outside of the region because this guy has an affinity for our hometown. So anyway, if anybody's looking for a connect to AngelSpan, let me know and I'll get you fixed up. So Thank you both for joining me on the show, for your insightful explanation of how to, you know, how to run a business and how to communicate it. So thank you both very much for bringing it today on the Mark Haney Show. Great show today. Talked about communication, and it's important no matter what you're doing, but it's certainly important as a CEO, as a business leader, when you're talking about advancing the ball with your investors. Because, I mean, if you don't communicate with them, a lot of times they think maybe you've dropped off. And the way, if you communicate well enough with them, they're pretty likely to continue to fund you throughout your growth journey. So that's what I do here at Haney Biz. I'm an angel investor. I'm a venture capitalist. And if you have interest in understanding more about how this world of angel investing works, how venture capital works, or you're an entrepreneur who is thinking about, you know, growing their company and maybe getting involved in venture capital or seeking venture capital, hit me up. I'm right here in the hometown of Sacramento, right here in Rockland. And Haney Biz, I want you to know we are never above you, never below you, but always by your side. This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in the segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.